Anyone who is put before us into the right condition is not for the first chance comer. If anyone can do it, it is the man who knows. Just as in medicine and all other matters which give scope for care and prudence. Must we not, then, next examine whence or how one can learn how to legislate? Is it, as in all other cases, from statesmen? Certainly it was thought to be a part of statesmanship. Or is a difference apparent between statesmanship and the other sciences and arts? In the others, the same people are found offering to teach the arts and practicing them, e.g. doctors or painters. But while the sophists profess to teach politics, it is practiced, not by any of them, but by the politicians, who would seem to do so by dint of a certain skill and experience, rather than of thought. For they are not found either writing or speaking about such matters, though it were a nobler occupation perhaps than composing speeches for the law courts and the assembly. Nor again are they found to have made statesmen of their own sons, or any other of their friends. But it was to be expected that they should if they could, for there is nothing better than such a skill that they could have left to their cities, or could prefer to have for themselves, or therefore for those dearest to them. Still, experience seems to contribute not a little, else they could not have become politicians by familiarity with politics, and so it seems that those who aim at knowing about the art of politics need experience as well. But those of the sophists who profess the art seem to be very far from teaching it. For to put the matter generally, they do not even know what kind of thing it is, nor what kinds of things it is about. Otherwise, they would not have classed it as identical with rhetoric or even inferior to it, nor have thought it easy to legislate by collecting the laws that are thought well of. They say it is possible to select the best laws, as though even the selection did not demand intelligence, and as though right judgment were not the greatest thing, as in matters of music. For while people experienced in any department judge rightly the works produced in it, and understand by what means or how they are achieved, and what harmonizes with what, the inexperienced must be content if they do not fail to see whether the work has been well or ill made, as in the case of painting. Now laws are, as it were, the works of the political art. How then can one learn from them to be a legislator or judge which are best? Even medical men do not seem to be made by study of textbooks, yet people try at any rate to state not only the treatments, but also how particular classes of people can be cured and should be treated, distinguishing the various habits of the body. But while this seems useful to experienced people, to the inexperienced it is valueless. Surely then, while collections of laws and of constitutions also may be serviceable to those who can study them and judge what is good or bad, and what enactments suit what circumstances, those who go through such collections without a practiced faculty will not have right judgment, unless it be as a spontaneous gift of nature, though they may perhaps become more intelligent in such matters. Now, our predecessors have left the subject of legislation to us unexamined. It is perhaps best, therefore, that we should ourselves study it, and in general study the question of the Constitution, in order to complete to the best of our ability our philosophy of human nature. First, then, if anything has been said well in detail by earlier thinkers, let us try to review it. Then, in the light of the constitutions we have collected, let us study what sorts of influence preserve and destroy states, and what sorts preserve or destroy the particular kinds of constitution, and to what causes it is due that some are well and others ill administered. When these have been studied, we shall perhaps be more likely to see with a comprehensive view which constitution is best, and how each must be ordered, and what laws and customs it must use if it is to be at its best. Let us make a beginning of our discussion. Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle, translated by W. D. Ross, was read by Andrew Cullum. Eudemian Ethics by Aristotle, translated by H. Rackham, read by Andrew Cullum. This treatise is one of the primary sources available for study of Aristotelian ethics. The work is named after Eudemus of Rhodes, a pupil of Aristotle who may also have had a hand in editing the final work. It is commonly believed to have been written before the Nicomachean Ethics, though this is not without controversy. The Eudemian Ethics is shorter than the Nicomachean Ethics, receiving much less critical attention, being composed of 8 books as opposed to 10, with some of its most interesting passages mirrored in the longer work. For example, books 4, 5, and 6 of the Eudemian Ethics are identical to books 5, 6, and 7 of the Nicomachean Ethics, and therefore they are omitted in this recording. One of the more prominent and original differences in the Eudemian Ethics can be found in Book 8, in a section concerning kallokagathia, the beautiful and good nobility of a gentleman, a virtue which implies all the moral virtues as well as good fortune. This tenet has no parallel in the Nicomachean Ethics. Book 1. The man who at Delos set forth in the precinct of the god his own opinion composed an inscription for the forecourt of the temple of Leto, in which he distinguished goodness, beauty, and pleasantness, as not all being properties of the same thing. His verses are, "Justice is fairest and health is best, but to win one's desire is the pleasantest." But for our part, let us not allow that he is right, for happiness is at once the pleasantest and the fairest and best of all things whatever. About every thing and every natural species there are many views that involve difficulty and require examination. Of these, some relate only to our knowledge of the thing, others deal also with modes of acquiring it and of acting in relation to it. As to all those views, therefore, that involve only speculative philosophy, we must say whatever may be proper to the inquiry when the suitable occasion occurs. But we must consider first what the good life consists in and how it is to be obtained. Whether all of those who receive the designation happy acquire happiness by nature, as is the case with tallness and shortness of stature, and differences of complexion or by study, which would imply that there is a science of happiness, or by some form of training. For there are many human attributes that are not bestowed by nature, nor acquired by study, but gained by habituation, bad attributes by those trained in bad habits and good attributes by those trained in good ones. Or does happiness come in none of these ways, but either by a sort of elevation of mind inspired by some divine power, as in the case of persons possessed by a nymph or a god, or alternatively by fortune? For many people identify happiness with good fortune. Now it is pretty clear that the presence of happiness is bestowed upon men by all of these things, or by some or one of them, for almost all the modes in which it is produced fall under these principles, inasmuch as all the acts that spring from thought may be included with those that spring from knowledge. But to be happy, and to live blissfully and finely, may consist chiefly in 3 things deemed to be most desirable. Some people say that wisdom is the greatest good, others goodness, and others pleasure. And certain persons debate about their importance in relation to happiness. 1214b. Declaring that one contributes more to it than another, some holding that wisdom is a greater good than goodness, others the reverse, and others that pleasure is a greater good than either of them, And some think that the happy life comes from them all, others from two of them, others that it consists in some one of them. Having then, in regard to this subject, established that everybody able to live according to his own purposive choice should set before him some object for noble living to aim at, either honour or else glory or wealth or culture, on which he will keep his eyes fixed in all his conduct, since clearly it is a mark of much folly not to have one's life regulated with regard to some end, it is therefore most necessary first to decide within oneself, neither hastily nor carelessly, in which of the things that belong to us the good life consists, and what are the indispensable conditions for men's possessing it. For there is a distinction between health and the things that are indispensable conditions of health, and this is similarly the case with many other things. Consequently, also, to live finely is not the same as the things without which living finely is impossible. And in the latter class of things, some that are indispensable conditions of health and life are not peculiar to special people, but common to practically all men, both some states and some actions. For instance, without breathing, or being awake, or participating in movement, we could not possess any good or any evil at all, whereas others are more peculiar to special types of natural constitution, for instance, eating meat and taking walking exercise after dinner, are not closely related to health in the same way as the conditions mentioned. And these facts must not be overlooked, for these are the causes of the disputes about the real nature of happiness and about the means of procuring it. For some people regard the things that are indispensable conditions of being happy as actual parts of happiness. Now, to examine all the opinions that any people hold about happiness is a superfluous task, for children and the sick and insane have many opinions which no sensible man would discuss. For these persons need not argument, but the former time in which to grow up and alter, and the latter medical or official chastisement, treatment with drugs being chastisement just as much as flogging is. And similarly, it is also superfluous to examine the opinions of the multitude either, 1215a. For they talk at random about almost everything, and especially about happiness. We ought to examine only the opinions of the wise, for it is out of place to apply reasoning to those who do not need reasoning at all, but experience. But since every subject has special difficulties related to it, it is clear that there are such in regard to the highest life and the best mode of existence. It is then well to examine the opinions putting these difficulties, since the refutations advanced by those who challenge them are demonstrations of the theories that are opposed to them. Moreover, to notice such matters is especially advantageous with a view to the subjects to which all inquiry ought to be directed. The question, what are the means that make it possible to participate in living well and finally, if blissfully is too invidious an expression, and with a view to the hope that we may have of the things that are good in the various departments. For if living finely depends on things that come by fortune or by nature, it would be beyond the hopes of many men, for then its attainment is not to be secured by effort, and does not rest with men themselves, and is not a matter of their own conduct. But if it consists in oneself and one's own actions having a particular quality, the good would be more common and more divine. More common, because it would be possible for more people to share it, and more divine, because happiness would then be in store for those who made themselves and their actions of a particular quality. Most of the points debated and the difficulties raised will be clear if it be satisfactorily determined what the proper conception of happiness is. Does it consist merely in a person's possessing some particular quality of spirit, as some of the sages and the older thinkers held, or although a particular personal character is indeed an indispensable condition, is a particular quality of conduct even more necessary? There are various different modes of life, and some do not lay any claim to well-being of the kind under consideration, but are pursued merely for the sake of things necessary. For instance, the lives devoted to the vulgar and mechanic arts, and those dealing with business. By vulgar arts, I mean those pursued only for reputation, by mechanic, the sedentary and wage-earning pursuits, and by arts of business, those concerned with market purchase and retail selling. But on the other hand, the things related to the happy conduct of life being three, the things already mentioned as the greatest possible goods for men, goodness, wisdom and pleasure, we see that there are also three ways of life in which those to whom fortune gives opportunity invariably choose to live, the life of politics, the life of philosophy, and the life of enjoyment. 1215b. Of these, the philosophic life denotes being concerned with the contemplation of truth. The political life means being occupied with honourable activities, and these are the activities that spring from goodness. And the life of enjoyment is concerned with the pleasures of the body. Owing to this, different people give the name of happy to different persons, as was said before too. And Anaxagoras of Clazomenae, when asked who is the happiest man, said, "None of those whom you think, but he would seem to you an odd sort of person." But Anaxagoras answered in that way because he saw that the man who put the question supposed it to be impossible to receive the appellation happy without being great and beautiful or rich, whereas he himself perhaps thought that the person who, humanly speaking, enjoys bliss is he that lives by the standard of justice without pain and in purity, or participates in some form of divine contemplation. While there are many different things as to which it is not easy to make a right judgment, this is especially the case with one about which everybody thinks that it is very easy to judge and that anybody can decide. The question, which of the things contained in being alive is preferable, and which, when attained, would fully satisfy a man's desire. For many of life's events are such that they cause men to throw life away. For instance, diseases, excessive pains, storms. So that it is clear that on account of these things anyway, it would actually be preferable, if someone offered us the choice, not to be born at all. And in addition, the kind of life that people live while still children is not desirable. In fact, no sensible person could endure to go back to it again. And further, many of the experiences that contain no pleasure nor pain, and also of those that do contain pleasure but pleasure of an ignoble kind, are such that non-existence would be better than being alive. And generally, if one collected together the whole of the things that the whole of mankind do and experience, yet do and experience unwillingly, because not for the sake of the things themselves, and if one added an infinite extent of time, these things would not cause a man to choose to be alive rather than not alive. But, moreover, also the pleasure of food or of sex alone, with the other pleasures abstracted that knowledge or sight or any other of the senses provides for human beings, would not induce anybody to value life higher if he were not utterly slavish. For it is clear that to one making this choice there would be no difference between being born a beast or a man, at all events, the ox in Egypt, 1216a, which they reverence as Apis, has a greater abundance of such indulgences than many monarchs. Nor, likewise, would anyone desire life for the pleasure of sleep either. For what is the difference between slumbering without being awakened from the first day till the last of a thousand or any number of years, and living a vegetable existence? Anyway, plants seem to participate in life of that kind, and so do children too. inasmuch as at their first procreation in the mother, though alive, they stay asleep all the time. So that it is clear from considerations of this sort that the precise nature of well-being and of the good in life escapes our investigation. Now it is said that when somebody persisted in putting various difficulties of this sort to Anaxagoras, and went on asking for what object one should choose to come into existence rather than not, he replied by saying, "For the sake of contemplating the heavens and the whole order of the universe." Anaxagoras therefore thought that the alternative of being alive was valuable for the sake of some kind of knowledge. But those who ascribe bliss to Sardanapalus or Smindyrides of Sybaris, or some of the others living the life of enjoyment, all appear for their part to place happiness in delight, while a different set would not choose either wisdom of any kind or the bodily pleasures in preference to the actions that spring from goodness. At all events, some people choose those actions not only for the sake of reputation, but even when they are not going to get any credit. But the majority of those engaged in politics are not correctly designated politicians, for they are not truly political, since the political man is one who purposely chooses noble actions for their own sake, whereas the majority embrace that mode of life for the sake of money and gain. What has been said, therefore, demonstrates that all men ascribe happiness to three modes of life: the political, the philosophic, and the life of enjoyment. Among these, the nature and quality of the pleasure connected with the body and with enjoyment, and the means that procure it, are not hard to see. So that it is not necessary for us to inquire what these pleasures are, but whether they conduce at all to happiness or not, and how they so conduce, and if it be the case that the noble life ought to have some pleasures attached to it, whether these are the pleasures that ought to be attached, or whether these must be enjoyed in some other way, whereas the pleasures which people reasonably believe to make the happy man's life pleasant, and not merely painless, are different ones. But these matters must be examined later. Let us first consider goodness and wisdom, what the nature of each is, and also whether they themselves, or the actions that spring from them, are parts of the good life. 1216b. Since that they are connected with happiness is asserted, if not by everybody, at all events by all of mankind who are worthy of consideration. Accordingly, Socrates the senior thought that the end is to get to know virtue, and he pursued an inquiry into the nature of justice and courage and each of the divisions of virtue. And this was a reasonable procedure, since he thought that all the virtues are forms of knowledge, so that knowing justice and being just must go together, for as soon as we have learnt geometry and architecture, we are architects and geometricians. Owing to which he used to inquire what virtue is, but not how and from what sources it is produced. But although this does happen in the case of the theoretical sciences, inasmuch as astronomy and natural science and geometry have no other end except to get to know and to contemplate the nature of things that are the subjects of the sciences, although it is true that they may quite possibly be useful to us accidentally for many of our necessary requirements, yet the end of the productive sciences is something different from science and knowledge. For example, the end of medicine is health, and that of political science, ordered government, or something of that sort, different from mere knowledge of the science. Although, therefore, it is fine even to attain a knowledge of the various fine things, all the same, nevertheless, in the case of goodness, it is not the knowledge of its essential nature that is most valuable, but the ascertainment of the sources that produce it. For our aim is not to know what courage is, but to be courageous. not to know what justice is, but to be just. In the same way as we want to be healthy, rather than to ascertain what health is, and to be in good condition of body, rather than to ascertain what good bodily condition is. And about all these matters the endeavour must be made to seek to convince by means of rational arguments, using observed facts as evidences and examples. For the best thing would be if all mankind were seen to be in agreement with the views that will be stated, but failing that, at any rate, that all should agree in some way. And this they will do if led to change their ground. For everyone has something relative to contribute to the truth, and we must start from this to give a sort of proof about our views. For from statements that are true, but not clearly expressed, as we advance, clearness will also be attained, if at every stage we adopt more scientific positions in exchange for the customary confused statements. And in every investigation, arguments stated in philosophical form are different from those that are non-philosophical. Hence we must not think that theoretical study of such a sort as to make manifest not only the nature of a thing but also its cause is superfluous even for the political student, since that is the philosophic procedure in every field of inquiry. Nevertheless, this requires much caution. 1217a. For because to say nothing at random, but use reasoned argument, seems to mark a philosopher, some people, often without being detected, advance arguments that are not germane to the subject under treatment, and that have nothing in them. And they do this sometimes through ignorance, and sometimes from charlatanry, which bring it about that even men of experience and practical capacity are taken in by these people who neither possess nor are capable of constructive or practical thought. And this befalls them owing to lack of education. For in respect of each subject, inability to distinguish arguments germane to the subject from those foreign to it is lack of education. And it is also well to judge separately the statement of the cause and the demonstrated fact, both for the reason stated just now, that it is not proper in regard to all things to attend to theoretical arguments, but often rather to the facts of observation, whereas now when men are unable to refute an argument they are forced to believe what has been said, and also because often, although the result that seems to have been proved by the arguments is true, it is not true because of the cause asserted in the argument. For it is possible to prove truth by falsehood, as is clear from analytics. These prefatory remarks having also been made, let us proceed by starting first from the first statements, which, as has been said, are not clearly expressed, afterwards seeking to discover clearly the essential nature of happiness. Now it is agreed that happiness is the greatest and best of human goods. And we say human, because there might very likely also be happiness belonging to some higher being, for instance a god. Since none of the other animals which are inferior in nature to men share in the designation happy, for a horse is not happy, nor is a bird, nor a fish, nor any other existing thing whose designation does not indicate that it possesses in its nature a share of something divine, but it is by some other mode of participating in things good that one of them has a better life and another a worse. But the fact that this is so must be considered later. At present, let us say that among things good, some are within the range of action for a human being and others are not. And we make this distinction for the reason that some existing things do not participate in change at all, and therefore some good things do not. And these are perhaps in their nature the best things, and some things, though practicable, are only practicable for beings superior to us. And inasmuch as practicable has two meanings, for both the ends for which we act and the actions that we do as means to those ends have to do with action. For example, we class among things practicable both health and wealth, and the pursuits that are followed for the sake of health and wealth, healthy exercise and lucrative business, it is clear that happiness must be set down as the best of the things practicable for a human being. 1217b. We must consider, therefore, what the best is, and in how many senses the term is used. The answer seems to be principally contained in three views, for it is said that the best of all things is the absolute good, and that the absolute good is that which has the attributes of being the first of goods and of being by its presence the cause to the other goods of their being good, and both of these attributes, it is said, belong to the form of good. I mean both being the first of goods and being by its presence the cause to the other goods of their being good. Since it is of that form that goodness is most truly predicated, inasmuch as the other goods are good by participation in and resemblance to the form of good, and also it is the first of goods, for the destruction of that which is participated in involves the destruction of the things participating in the form, which get their designation by participating in it. And that is the relation existing between what is primary and what is subsequent. So that the form of good is the absolute good, inasmuch as the form of good is separable from the things that participate in it, as are the other forms also. Now a thorough examination of this opinion belongs to another course of study, and one that for the most part necessarily lies more in the field of logic. For that is the only science dealing with arguments that are at the same time destructive and general. But if we are to speak about it concisely, we say that in the first place, to assert the existence of a form not only of good, but of anything else, is an expression of logic and a mere abstraction. But this has been considered in various ways, both in extraneous discourses and in those on philosophical lines. Next, even granting that forms and the form of good exist in the fullest sense, surely this is of no practical value for the good life or for conduct. For good has many senses, in fact as many as being. For the term is, as it has been analyzed in other works, signifies now substance, now quality, now quantity, now time, and in addition to these meanings, it consists now in undergoing change and now in causing it. And the good is found in each of these cases, in essence as mind and God, in quality justice, in quantity moderation, in time opportunity, and as instances of change, the teacher and the taught. Therefore, just as being is not some one thing in respect of the categories mentioned, so neither is the good. And there is no one science either of the real or of the good. But also even the goods predicated in the same category, for example, opportunity or moderation, do not fall within the province of a single science to study, but different sorts of opportunity and of moderation are studied by different sciences. For instance, opportunity and moderation in respect of food are studied by medicine and gymnastics, in respect of military operations by strategies, and similarly, in respect of another pursuit by another science, so that it can hardly be the case that the absolute good is the subject of only one science. 1218a. Again, wherever there is a sequence of factors, a prior and a subsequent, there is not some common element beside these factors and that element separable, for then there would be something prior to the first in the series, for the common and separable term would be prior because when the common element was destroyed, the first factor would be destroyed. For example, if double is the first of the multiples, The multiplicity predicated of them in common cannot exist as a separable thing. For then, it will be prior to double. If it is the case that the common element is the form, as it would be if one were to make the common element separable. For if justice is a good, and courage, there is then, they say, a good in itself. So the term in itself is added to the common definition. But what could this denote except that the good is eternal and separable? Yet a thing that is white for days is no more white than a thing that is white for one day. So that the good is no more good by being eternal, nor yet therefore is the common good the same as the form, for it is the common property of all the goods. Also, the proper method of proving the absolute good is the contrary to the method now adopted. At present, it is from things not admitted to possess goodness that they prove the things admitted to be good. For instance, they prove from numbers that justice and health are good, because they are arrangements and numbers, on the assumption that goodness is a property of numbers and monads, because the absolute good is unity. But the proper method is to start from things admitted to be good, for instance, health, strength, sobriety of mind, and prove that beauty is present even more in the unchanging, for all these admitted goods consist in order and rest, and therefore, if that is so, the things unchanging are good in an even greater degree, for they possess order and rest in a greater degree. And it is a hazardous way of proving that the absolute good is unity to say that numbers aim at unity. For it is not clearly stated how they aim at it, but the expression is used in too unqualified a manner. And how can one suppose that things not possessing life can have appetition? One ought to study this matter carefully, and not make an unreasoned assumption about something as to which it is not easy to attain certainty, even with the aid of reason. And the statement that all existing things desire some one good is not true. Each thing seeks its own particular good, the eye, sight, the body, health, and similarly, another thing, another good. Such, then, are the difficulties indicating that the absolute good does not exist, and that it is of no use for political science, but that it has a special good of its own, as have the other sciences too. For instance, the good of gymnastics is good bodily condition. Further, there is also what has been written in the discourse. Either the class form of the good is in itself useful to no science, or it is useful to all alike. Further, it is not practicable. And similarly, the good as universal also is not an absolute good. 1218b. For universality might be an attribute of even a small good. And also it is not practicable, for medical science does not study how to procure an attribute that belongs to anything, but how to procure health, and similarly also each of the other practical sciences. But good has many meanings, and there is a part of it that is beautiful, and one form of it is practicable, but another is not. The sort of good that is practicable is that which is an object aimed at. But the good in things unchangeable is not practicable. It is manifest, therefore, that the absolute good we are looking for is not the form of good, nor yet the good as universal. For the form is unchangeable and impracticable, and the universal good, though changeable, is not practicable. But the object aimed at as end is the chief good, and is the cause of the subordinate goods, and first of all, so that the absolute good would be this, the end of the goods practicable for man. And this is the good that comes under the supreme of all the practical sciences, which is politics and economics and wisdom. For these states of character differ from the others in the fact that they are supreme. Whether they differ at all from one another must be discussed later on. And that the end stands in a causal relation to the means subordinate to it is shown by the method of teachers. They prove that the various means are each good by first defining the end, because the end aimed at is a cause. For example, since to be in health is so-and-so, what contributes to health must necessarily be so-and-so. The wholesome is the efficient cause of health, though only the cause of its existing. It is not the cause of health's being a good. Furthermore, nobody proves that health is a good unless he is a sophist and not a physician. It is sophists that juggle with irrelevant arguments, any more than he proves any other first principle. After this, we must take a fresh starting point and consider with regard to the good as end for man, and in regard to the best of practicable goods, how many senses there are of the term best of all, since this is best. Book 2. After this, we must take a fresh starting point and discuss the subjects that follow. Now, all goods are either external or within the spirit. And of these two kinds, the latter are preferable, as we class them even in the extraneous discourses. For wisdom and goodness and pleasure are in the spirit. And either some or all of these are thought by everybody to be an end. And the contents of the spirit are in two groups, one states or faculties, the other activities and processes. Let these assumptions, then, be made, and let it be assumed as to goodness that it is the best disposition or state or faculty of each class of things that have some use or work. 1219a. This is clear from induction, for we posit this in all cases. For instance, there is a goodness that belongs to a coat, for a coat has a particular function and use, and the best state of a coat is its goodness. And similarly with a ship and a house and the rest, so that the same is true also of the spirit, for it has a work of its own. And therefore let us assume that the better the state is, the better is the work of that state. And that as states stand in relation to one another, so do the works that result from them. And the work of each thing is its end. From this, therefore, it is plain that the work is a greater good than the state. For the end is the best as being an end. Since the greatest good is assumed as an end, and as the ultimate object for the sake of which all the other things exist. It is clear, therefore, that the work is a greater good than the state and disposition. But the term work has two meanings. For some things have a work that is something different from the employment of them. For instance, the work of architecture is a house, not the act of building. That of medicine, health. Not the process of healing or curing. Whereas with other things their work is the process of using them. For instance, the work of sight is the act of seeing, that of mathematical science, the contemplation of mathematical truths. So it follows that with the things whose work is the employment of them, the act of employing them must be of more value than the state of possessing them. And these points having been decided in this way, we say that the same work belongs to a thing and to its goodness, although not in the same way. For example, a shoe is the work of the art of shoemaking and the act of shoemaking. So if there is such a thing as shoemaking goodness and a good shoemaker, their work is a good shoe. And in the same way, in the case of the other arts also. Again, let us grant that the work of the spirit is to cause life, and that being alive is employment, and being awake, for sleep is a kind of inactivity and rest, with the consequence that since the work of the Spirit and that of its goodness are necessarily one and the same, the work of goodness would be good life. Therefore, this is the perfect good, which, as we saw, is happiness. And it is clear from the assumptions laid down, for we said that happiness is the greatest good, and that the ends, or the greatest of goods, are in the Spirit. But things in the Spirit are either a state or an activity, that since an activity is a better thing than a disposition, and the best activity than the best state, and since goodness is the best state, the activity of goodness is the Spirit's greatest good. But also we saw that the greatest good is happiness. Therefore, happiness is the activity of a good spirit. And since we saw that happiness is something perfect, and life is either perfect or imperfect, and the same with goodness, for some goodness is a whole, and some a part, but the activity of imperfect things is imperfect, it would follow that happiness is an activity of perfect life in accordance with perfect goodness. And that our classification and definition of it are correct is evidenced by opinions that we all hold. 1219b. For we think that to do well and live well are the same as to be happy, but each of these, both life and action, is employment and activity, inasmuch as active life involves employing things. The coppersmith makes a bridle, but the horseman uses it. There is also the evidence of the opinion that a person is not happy for one day only, and that a child is not happy, nor any period of life. Hence also Solon's advice holds good, not to call a man happy while he is alive, but only when he has reached the end. For nothing incomplete is happy, since it is not a whole. And again, there are the praises given to goodness on account of its deeds, and panegyrics describing deeds, and it is the victorious who are given wreaths, not those who are capable of winning but do not win. And there is the fact that we judge a man's character from his actions. Also, why is happiness not praised? It is because it is on account of it that the other things are praised, either by being placed in relation to it, or as being parts of it. Hence, felicitation, praise, and panegyric are different things. Panegyric is a recital of a particular exploit, praise a statement of a man's general distinction, felicitation is bestowed on an end achieved. From these considerations, light is also thrown on the question sometimes raised. What is the precise reason why the virtuous are for half their lives no better than the base, since all men are alike when asleep? The reason is that sleep is inaction of the spirit, not an activity. Hence the goodness of any other part of the spirit, for instance, the nutritive, is not a portion of goodness as a whole, just as also goodness of the body is not, for the nutritive part functions more actively in sleep, whereas the sensory and appetitive parts are ineffective in sleep. But even the imaginations of the virtuous, so far as the imaginative faculty participates in any mode of motion, are better than those of the base, provided they are not perverted by disease or mutilation. Next, we must study the spirit. For goodness is a property of the spirit, it is not accidental. And since it is human goodness that we are investigating, let us begin by positing that the spirit has two parts that partake of reason, but that they do not both partake of reason in the same manner, but one of them by having by nature the capacity to give orders, and the other to obey and listen. Let us leave out any part that is irrational in another way. And it makes no difference whether the spirit is divisible or is undivided yet possessed of different capacities, namely those mentioned, Just as the concave and convex sides in a curve are inseparable, and the straightness and whiteness in a straight white line, although a straight thing is not white except accidentally and not by its own essence. And we have also abstracted any other part of the spirit that there may be, for instance, the factor of growth. For the parts that we have mentioned are the special properties of the human spirit, and hence the excellences of the parts dealing with nutrition and growth are not the special property of a man, for necessarily, if considered as a man, he must possess a reasoning faculty for a principle and with a view to conduct, 1220a. And the reasoning faculty is a principle controlling not reasoning, but appetite and passions. Therefore he must necessarily possess those parts. And just as a good constitution consists of the separate excellences of the parts of the body, so also the goodness of the spirit, as being an end, is composed of the separate virtues. And goodness has two forms: moral virtue and intellectual excellence. For we praise not only the just, but also the intelligent and the wise. For we assumed that what is praiseworthy is either goodness or its work. And these are not activities, but possess activities. And since the intellectual excellences involve reason, these forms of goodness belong to the rational part, which, as having reason, is in command of the spirit, whereas the moral virtues belong to the part that is irrational, but by nature capable of following the rational. For in stating a man's moral qualities, we do not say that he is wise or clever, but that he is gentle or rash. After this, we must first consider moral goodness, its essence, and the nature of its divisions, for that is the subject now arrived at, and the means by which it is produced. Our method of inquiry, then, must be that employed by all people in other matters when they have something in hand to start with. We must endeavour by means of statements that are true but not clearly expressed to arrive at a result that is both true and clear. For our present state is as if we knew that health is the best disposition of the body, and that Coriscus is the darkest man in the marketplace. For that is not to know what health is, and who Coriscus is, but nevertheless to be in that state is a help towards knowing each of these things. Then let it first be taken as granted that the best disposition is produced by the best means, and that the best actions in each department of conduct result from the excellences belonging to each department. For example, it is the best exercises and food that produce a good condition of body, and a good condition of body enables men to do the best work. Further, that every disposition is both produced and destroyed by the same things applied in a certain manner. For example, health by food and exercises and climate. These points are clear from induction. Therefore, goodness, too, is the sort of disposition that is created by the best movements in the spirit, and is also the source of the production of the spirit's best actions and emotions. And it is in one way produced, and in another way destroyed by the same things. And its employment of the things that cause both its increase and its destruction is directed towards the things towards which it creates the best disposition. And this is indicated by the fact that both goodness and badness have to do with things pleasant and painful. For punishments, which are medicines, and which, as is the case with other cures, operate by means of opposites, operate by means of pleasures and pains. It is clear, therefore, that moral goodness has to do with pleasures and pains. And since moral character is, 1220b, as even its name implies, that it has its growth from habit, and by our often moving in a certain way a habit not innate in us is finally trained to be operative in that way, which we do not observe in inanimate objects, for not even if you throw a stone upwards 10,000 times will it ever rise upward, unless under the operation of force. Let moral character, then, be defined as a quality of the spirit in accordance with governing reason that is capable of following the reason. We have then to say, what is the part of the spirit in respect of which our moral characters are of a certain quality? And it will be in respect of our faculties for emotions, according to which people are termed liable to some emotion, and also of the states of character, according to which people receive certain designations in respect of the emotions, because of their experiencing or being exempt from some form of emotion. After this comes the classification, made in previous discussions, of the modes of emotion, the faculties, and the states of character. By emotions I mean such things as anger, fear, shame, desire, and generally those experiences that are in themselves usually accompanied by sensory pleasure or pain. And to these there is no quality corresponding, but they are passive. But quality corresponds to the faculties. By faculties, I mean the properties acting by which persons are designated by the names of the various emotions, for instance, choleric, insensitive, erotic, bashful, shameless. States of character are the states that cause the emotions to be present, either rationally or the opposite. For example, courage, sobriety of mind, cowardice, profligacy. These distinctions having been established, it must be grasped that in every continuum that is divisible there is excess and deficiency and a mean, and these either in relation to one another or in relation to us. For instance, in gymnastics or medicine or architecture or navigation, and in any practical pursuit of whatever sort, both scientific and unscientific, both technical and untechnical, for motion is a continuum and conduct is a motion. And in all things the mean to relation to us is the best, for that is as knowledge and reason bid. And everywhere this also produces the best state. This is proved by induction and reason. Contraries are mutually destructive, and extremes are contrary both to each other and to the mean, as the mean is either extreme in relation to the other. For example, the equal is greater than the less, and the less than the greater. Hence moral goodness must be concerned with certain means, and must be a middle state. We must therefore ascertain what sort of middle state is goodness, and with what sort of means it is concerned. Let each then be taken by way of illustration, and studied with the help of the schedule. Irascibility, spiritlessness, gentleness, rashness, cowardice, courage, 1221a, shamelessness, diffidence, modesty, profligacy, insensitiveness, temperance, envy, nameless, righteous indignation, profit, loss, the just, prodigality, meanness, liberality, boastfulness, self-depreciation, sincerity, flattery, surliness, friendliness, subservience, stubbornness, dignity, luxuriousness, endurance, hardiness, vanity, smallness of spirit, greatness of spirit, extravagance, shabbiness, magnificence, rascality, simpleness, wisdom. These and such as these are the emotions that the spirit experiences, and they are all designated from being either excessive, or defective. The man that gets angry more and more quickly and with more people than he ought is irascible. He that in respect of persons and occasions and manner is deficient in anger is insensitive. The man that is not afraid of things of which he ought to be afraid, nor when, nor as he ought, is rash. He that is afraid of things of which he ought not to be afraid, and when, and as he ought not to be, is cowardly.